We'll call the meeting to order. We actually have a quorum. Can you imagine that? We have members all over the place today in various other committees and so forth. So, folks, welcome to the Commerce Committee. Up first is Representative Hillstrom's bill. Representative Hillstrom moves the... I suppose we'll do the minutes first. Representative Woodard, I know you've studied them thoroughly, and we'll move the minutes of the February 6, 2013 minutes be approved. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion carries, and the minutes are approved. Next up is House File 157. Representative Hillstrom is a member of the Commerce Committee, and she moves House File 157 to be reckoned and passed and referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Representative Hillstrom, welcome. We'll look forward to having you walk us through the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, House File 157 was brought to me from the Attorney General's office, and this is a bill that relates to bullion coin dealers. And with me today is Kermit Frickdee from the Attorney General's office, and I'd like him to walk you through the bill and share with you a few stories which caused this bill to come to this committee.
And Representative Hillstrom is the 835, it's actually 813-0035. Is that your amendment? Is that an author's amendment?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair, and I would move that the 813-0035 be amended onto House File 157 to get the bill in the shape that I would like it.
Okay, and as is tradition in the Commerce Committee, author's amendments are routinely placed on the bill so the author can move the through the bill in the fashion that they desire. All in favor of the 813-0035 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Sir.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Hillstrom, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Frickdee from the Attorney General's office.
And Mr. Frickdee, welcome back to the Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kermit Frickdee. I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Attorney General's office, and I'm one of the attorneys that's been involved in some of the consumer enforcement actions involving coin dealers and coin sales. The legislation that you have before you is designed to address the problem of fraudulent and unscrupulous coin dealers. The Attorney General's office has seen numerous complaints over the past several years, and I just want to give you a couple examples of what we've seen. You have, I think, on a fact sheet there an example of in 2012, an 80-year-old man received an unsolicited call from a coin dealer who convinced him to pay almost $12,000 for coins. As is common in these cases, the coin company convinced him to have it electronically wired, the funds electronically wired to the company. After the consumer did that, the coins never showed up and that person never got his money back. We also received a complaint from an 82-year-old woman who also received an unsolicited call, and these calls come because there are lists of people who have purchased coins in the past that get circulated around the country from coin dealer to coin dealer. And she was convinced to pay $12,000 for 10 coins last May. Later, she got admitted to the hospital, then to a nursing home. The coins never showed up, and she was never able to get her money back. In response to this problem, we've noticed that there are several common denominators in many of these cases. A lot of the representatives in the cases where we've brought have criminal backgrounds. They use high-pressure sales tactics, primarily targeted against seniors. There's often a real lack of any documentation provided along with these sales. It's simply a phone call, and sometimes there's almost an email confirmation but no actual invoice. And they almost always take place through the mail. Now, our office has filed 4 consumer protection actions in the last couple of years. In February of 2011, sued a company called Reputable Rare Coin and its owner, Tory Hughes. Now, Mr. Hughes had worked at another coin company, but he had a criminal record for theft and forgery. As a result of that case, we received a judgment against him, barring him from doing business in the coin industry in Minnesota. A couple months later, our office sued a company called Crescent Equities and its owner, Robert Earl Gundy. Mr. Gundy also had convictions for theft and check forgery. As a result of that case, we obtained a judgment barring him from doing business in Minnesota. Now, both of these judgments also contained large restitution amounts, but the fact of the matter is these individuals are either incarcerated or have no means to pay these judgments. There was another case brought in November of 2012 against the Stella Group and a woman called Tiffany Grady. Again, that was for people sent money to this woman, tens of thousands of dollars, and she did not deliver the coins. That case is pending in Ramsey County and should be wrapped up hopefully here in the next couple months. And just last month, our office sued a company called Guardian Gold and Silver Exchange, and its owners, Ray Hansico and Sean Waste. Now, that case is pending in Hennepin County, and there's also bankruptcy that goes along with that. In all these cases, we focused on companies that did not deliver the coins that were promised and paid for, or refused to give them, pay the money that was promised in exchange for coins. The solution is what you have before you, House File 157. It's essentially a bill that is supported by both AARP and the Commerce Department. It sets up
The Better Business Bureau.
I'm sorry. There's someone from the Better Business Bureau here today to testify. It requires registration. It also states that no coin dealer or coin dealer representative can get into this business with a felony within the last 15 years or a crime involving fraud, or if they've failed to pay consumers and there are judgments against them, unsatisfied judgments. It also sets forth in ADG.07 prohibited conduct and violations of that. Some of the violations for that result in a misdemeanor, a criminal misdemeanor, and the others are violations that are punishable or under the jurisdiction of the Commerce Department, but also the Attorney General's office. As you can see in the amendment, there's been a little change to the surety bond requirement. The surety bond requirement is modeled after some of the other statutes, and it's not designed to deal with situations where there's a dispute over a commission or the value of a coin. It's designed for when a dealer simply does not deliver the money or the coins. With that, I will end my comments and open it up to questions.
And thank you, Mr. Frickley. I think there are a couple questions for you. We've got Representative Anseltz and then Representative Swedzinski. Representative Anseltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to say that in the north woods of Minnesota, where I come from, I've never heard of a fraudulent coin dealer before. I don't know who they are or where they live or if any of them are in my neighborhood. Can you give us any idea of how many of these fraudulent coin dealers there are so the committee can get a little bit of an idea about how big of a problem this is?
We're actually going to give them your home number, Representative Anseltz. They'll be in touch. Mr. Frechtig, you have a...
Mr. Chair, Representative Anseltz. The representative from the Better Business Bureau can also speak to the number of complaints they see, but they range from one of the companies that our office sued, the Stella Group, was one person operating out of her house, primarily through the internet and the phone. There are numerous, they range from businesses that do millions of dollars a year worth of business to much smaller entities, just one or two people working out of a boiler room. In fact, many of the companies that we've dealt with are started up by people who leave their prior place of employment and set up their own shop. So these companies aren't also just Minnesota businesses. These are businesses who telephone and email and mail solicit folks in Minnesota. We have complaints about coin companies throughout the country.
Thank you, Mr. Frickley. Representative Anseltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Unless you want to be Anseltz.
No,
I don't blame you if you would.
A great guy.
Good-looking
great
guy. Representative Anseltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up. So are we talking hundreds of people, hundreds of complaints a year, 5,000 complaints a year, 5,000 people? I was unaware, and I should have been aware, that it's a nationwide problem, of course.
Mr. Frickley?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anseltz, our office has not received 5,000 complaints, but the number is over 100.
Over 100.
And Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question kind of goes into Section 3 there on the top portion, looking at the 15-year exclusion when it comes to coin dealer registration and the prior felony. What areas, other areas of business do we require something like that, where you have that long, 15 years seems like a bit of time. What is this a new, do we have other areas that takes? Go ahead.
Mr. Frickley.
Mr. Chair, Representative, There are certainly other areas of the law where there are bars for criminal convictions for fraud or felonies. I'm not aware of the timelines that are connected with them. I know there are some bars in securities, for example. There are also some bars in debt collection.
So,
Representative,
Mr. Chair, so does the felony, can it be in any sort of a fraud or base, or can it, has it has to be kind of into this sector? Like, are we going to limit, you know, say someone, you know, I mean, is it going to be a focused area that these people are going to be barred from the industry, or is it going to be just anyone that happens to have something in their record?
Mr. Frick.
And Mr. Chair, Representative, the language as written mentions any felony in addition to crimes involving fraud or deceit, but I think that the author is willing to look at, you know, look at any concerns that are raised, whether is it the timeline or is the more specificity desired in the felony. Is that what you're getting at?
Mm-hmm.
Representative Swazinski.
And then when it comes to, you know, obviously you've gotten 100 phone calls, 100 people that have experienced fraud or felt that some call, what percentage of those were from people that we'd actually be able to control from being in the state mm-hmm. versus outside of the state?
Mr. Fricke.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm trying to think. I think it's a pretty good split between companies within the state and outside of the state, because our office tends to get, if a company's located here, a lot of consumers will be in another state will be directed to our office. Similarly, our office receives complaints from Minnesota people who are dealing with companies outside of the state. So it is a pretty even split, but it's not uncommon for states to require at least registration for out-of-state companies to do business here. For example, debt collection, debt settlement, there's a registration requirement in order to do business in the state.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So from the complaint process, looking from a large business to a small business, you know, you've mentioned that some of these folks are in their basements or kind of starting this. Maybe they've left a larger firm, went to a smaller firm. Are you finding that the folks that you've got indicted, whether it be Ramsey or Hennepin County, are they? Is this their primary actor? I mean, are all the transactions that they've done been fraudulent, or has it been a percentage of those transactions been fraudulent, or?
Mr. Frick, you know, Swazinski, I never know when you're done asking your question.
I'm sorry.
And then it's like, it's a good question.
I thought my name was Enzel earlier. So, you know,
all right. Mr.
Chair, Representative Swazinski, in some of the cases, every transaction we've seen has been fraudulent. Now, there have also been examples, though, some of those consumers have said, well, I did business with this person years ago and the transaction went fine. There are other examples where, for reasons we don't know, the entity engaged in fraudulent transactions with some of its customers, but not others. And there's other ones we just haven't been able to get the records because the company folded up shop.
Okay. Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a couple of fairly quick questions here. One is just a follow-up on Representative Swazinski's question. And as I was looking at the relation of conviction to employment or occupation under Minnesota Statute 364.03, it talks about, notwithstanding any other provision of law, which this might be, a license is required solely or in part because of prior conviction of a crime or crimes unless those crimes relate to the position of employment sought. So I think that's kind of what Representative Swazinski is getting at, and I appreciate the fact you'd be willing to take a look at that. So I think that's where he's headed. I'm not done with my question yet. I'll say stop, maybe, to make sure we know. The other question I had was just in terms of the cost of this. I understand there's no fiscal note, right? The Department of Commerce isn't going to ask for money. But what is the cost of this with fees and registration fees and that for dealers themselves?
Mr. Chair and members, we are currently working with Commerce on what numbers should be filled in the blank here. There are other areas that have higher amounts in the $500 range and some with lower amounts. And so we are working with Commerce to make sure we get the right number, and we don't know what that number is yet. So it right now it just has the fill in the blanks.
Okay.
And Representative Woodward, to that point, is that we've kind of reserved the right, depending on how the fiscal note comes out and whose budget it falls into. If need be, it would come back to the Commerce Committee as a fiscal committee. But I know, Representative Hillstrom, you've got to go to a couple more stops. and we wanted to ensure an opportunity for other legislators and other committees to have some input in the bill. We'll see what the fiscal note comes back at, and then we may or may not bring it back to here.
And Mr.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just so you know, we have been working with the industry, and the amendment that we adopted reflected some of the concerns that they raised. And so we have been working very hard to make certain that we work with the folks that will be affected by this.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, just one quick final question here. There's a letter in our packets from Mr. Fahey on behalf of the Minnesota State Auctioneers Association, and there's a just a bevy of Fahey's in my area who are auctioneers. So when I see that, I take what he's saying here very seriously. They're concerned about auctions, and maybe that's part of the amendment that you're talking about that would help address some of this, but they seem concerned that how would they be affected when they're going to end of life or major life change sales and auctions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have met with the auctioneers. We have been talking to them. We want to make sure that we address the issue without creating a loophole of these unscrupulous folks than just going via auction. So we want to be very thoughtful, but we are working with the auctioneers as well.
Representative Woodard, anything else?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Zellers.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Woodard got two out of the way. The fee is always concerning, and the length of the contract. And with all due respect to the Attorney General's office, I mean, I think it is kind of important for us to know if you're going to have a new disqualification period, that it's got to be in some way in line with something else in the market. I don't think, with all due respect, it's fair for you to say to the committee, well, we're not really sure where it compares to other, say, insurance dealers or. You know, you pick your subject area. I think we should know where it fits on the scale. If this is really extreme, or if it's too soft, quite honestly, I think we got to have a little bit more description of what 15 years looks like. Especially when I circled the in any court, in any crime. So I think that leaves it pretty broad. I'm not an attorney, so I doesn't necessarily make that big of a deal legally. I just want to know if you're going to keep somebody out of the market for a mistake. For 15 years, I mean, it seems a little harsh, but I'd appreciate a little bit more description of how that fits in usual business disqualification periods. And then the fee was the other part that was very concerning, because anytime we're adding new fees, especially for somebody who isn't in the business and wants to get in. But the screening process was also, is this going to be a... on page 3 of the bill, the screening requirement and then the initial screening, is this going to be an industry-established standard, or is it going to be Commerce Department established?
Mr. Frickley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zellers, on the screening issue, I'm not sure if I understand the question. As the bill is written, it would be a... The standard is the National Association of Professional Background Screeners. That's how it's written. So I think it's something that has to pass the Commerce Department's muster. I know that we've been working with the industry on trying to find the best way that the screening would work for them. I mean, the idea is that a screening is done and it's verifiable. And I think working forward, that's what we're just trying to get to, something that actually has looked in the databases that are out there and accomplished it.
Sure.
Yeah. So. Oh, and Representative Ziller.
Sure, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I was just making sure we were on standard or on par with, since we're going to have, if the complaints are 50-50, we're either more difficult or more lax in Minnesota. I'm just making sure we're on par with other areas. And then the amendment with the surety bond, what is, from a cost standpoint to the dealers, is that, again, as we're talking about a pretty wide variety of folks here, from just big dealers down to, and again, some of them maybe shouldn't be small dealers, and that's how they got into this problem, but what is that surety bond? What does that look like for an annual expense to one of the sellers?
Mr. Frickley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zellers, it's our understanding that's approximately 1% is the dollar amount, 1% of the face of the bond.
Okay.
And
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could get to the 15 years, that might be part of my criminal law coming into the bill. I apologize. But when someone commits a felony, you can count the criminal history score point for 15 years after they're discharged from probation. And so that's kind of 15 years.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom, or Representative Zellers, anything else to that?
I always like a little legal teaching in Commerce Committee, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that kind of actually reminded me of a question. My background is more in private security-related things, you know, how companies hire folks and how they screen them and those kinds of things. And in that case, it's usually they're not allowed to look past 5 years, sometimes 7 years, in those kinds of cases. So that may be something that we would look at as being a little bit more equivalent to what we're talking about here rather than the 15 years, but from a screening standpoint.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am certain this is going to go to civil law, and they certainly, because there's background checks involved, and I am certain civil law will be talking with us about how many years they're going to let us look back.
I think you're right. Okay. Are there other questions? At this point, I also want to see if there's anybody else that desires to be heard with respect to the bill. But Representative Sanders, before we ask for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, Mr. Fruchty, I know... in doing some research, we found the recent federal court decision in Ohio. I don't know if you're aware of that or not, but I guess that'll be one of my questions, and if you constructed this piece of legislation around that. But they found that the law regulating the purchase and sale of precious metals, including the bullion coins, was infringement on commercial speech. And I think what they were doing was saying... you had to have a license to advertise, but they didn't say that you need a license to sell. But I know that your bill here does both. So I was just wondering if you guys had read through that court decision and if you thought there might be any complications with that.
Mr. Fichte.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanders, I'm not intimately familiar with that decision, but I will say that the speech that's being regulated in this bill is simply, it's really no different than a lot of the speech that's regulated by the Consumer Fraud Act, the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. It just requires people to be honest, and this isn't, and so I don't think, we obviously wouldn't be putting forth a bill that we felt wouldn't pass constitutional muster, so I think that the speech restrictions in there, are restrictions that would pass constitutional tests.
Anything else, Representative Sanders?
No, look forward to any other.
Representative Swazinski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just my other concern is, obviously, are we reinventing the wheel? I mean, are we kind of forging ahead here as kind of the first state that's doing this? And then my guess is we probably maybe are. And then what's Wisconsin doing? What's South Dakota, North Dakota? What are some of... our neighbors doing when it comes to this specific area,
Mr. Fricke, because there's certain laws that we've obviously been able to move forward with, but this is a little bit more specific to this trade, right, Mr. Fricke?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Swandinsky. The coin industry is largely unregulated in the United States. You have the FTC regulates some transactions of precious metals, but not really. It's really a hodgepodge of laws, and there really isn't anything, and that's one of the problems. That's why this is allowed to go unchecked. So this isn't, for example, modeled over after Wisconsin, South Dakota, things like that.
Anyone else with questions at this point? I do want to ask whether Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the witness. That just kind of sparked a question with me. If we're the only state that's going to have any regulation, we're the only state that's not going to have any coin dealers. Is that possible?
Oh,
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some coin dealers that are going to testify in favor of my bill that are here in Minnesota. So.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, does this have David? Continuing education in it?
He did doing education. No, Mr. Chair.
All right. I think you might have just gotten one vote there. I don't know. But anything else? Questions from members? Or anyone here today that desires to be heard with respect to this bill? Thank you, Mr. Fricke. Sir, welcome to the Commerce Committee. If you'll just identify yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Yep, my name is Bill Gale.
And you're up.
I'm here today in favor of this proposed legislation.
My name again, Bill Gale. I'm president of Asset Marketing, which is a fairly large coin company. We were founded in 1984. Our headquarters is in Burnsville, Minnesota. We employ 406 Minnesotans at our company. The industry is comprised mostly of legitimate dealers, but there are some fraudulent dealers that have operated in Minnesota and also from outside the state, selling to consumers in the state. We share the same goals as the Attorney General and Representative Hillstrom. We are encouraged with the work that has been done on this. There are still some matters of wording that need to work out, but again, we are confident that those will be worked out. This, you know, I think would be good for the industry, that there does need to be some rules put in place here. And again, I thank everybody for their time. If anybody's got any questions, fire away.
Thank you, Mr. Gale. I think what we'll do is we'll make sure to hear from, it looks like we've got someone else that would like to share his thoughts with us. So
thank
you. Could just identify yourself for the record.
My name is Gary Adkins, and that's with a D, not a T.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for coming. We've appreciated your testimony.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that I'm here basically in support of this bill. And I represent, and I'm not a lobbyist, I'm not an attorney, but I'm here on behalf of the coin dealers and precious metal dealers in Minnesota. And I say that for the most part, I think that there would be broad-based support for this bill as it's been amended and as you have it here today. So I think it's a good thing that we've introduced this. It's been a long time coming, and it's definitely been needed. And I think all of the legitimate dealers in Minnesota will support this this bill. And by the way, the people that have been prosecuted as a result of coin fraud have not been members of our organizations. They're typically people that work on the fringe of the business and just take advantage of people. They're in for a short time and then they're out. The question was asked earlier also about how many cases of this have there been. And basically, it's only been a handful of people that have been prosecuted, probably hundreds of complaints, but I think it centers around that handful of people that have been prosecuted. Most press releases have stated that the problems have occurred for non-delivery or what's called churning consumers or misrepresentation. And if you're not familiar with churning, basically what a person will do is call up a client that they know has purchased coins in the past. They'll offer them a big profit on the coins they purchased and then overcharge them on the items that they trade them for, and that's how they make their profit. We're in support of this. Obviously, we need some consideration for the so-called unintended consequences of the bill. There's a few of those, and I think for the most part we've been very successful in working with the Attorney General's office and Representative Hillstrom and getting those ironed out, and I have no doubt we'll continue doing that. Minnesota businesses that buy and sell coins and precious metals are widely diversified. It's not only coin dealers that are buying and selling precious metals. One that I didn't think of before, but the auctioneers is an example of that. They're providing a service, so they're not directly dealing in coins and precious metals. But also, there's antique dealers, pawnbrokers, jewelers, and so on that also deal in coins and precious metals. So that needs to be considered in thoughts on this bill. And they're also, most of these people are also covered by what's called secondhand dealer laws in the municipality that they're located in. Each of the, some of the counties and some of the cities have secondhand dealer laws that regulate these people as well. Had this been passed with the original bonding requirement in it, I think that it would have probably put a lot of small dealers out of business because they wouldn't be able to afford the bond. And that's going to vary. That cost of that bond is going to vary a lot, I believe, just based on the person's background and the amount of years they've been in business, their assets, and that type of thing. So it'll vary quite a bit. And I think most business owners don't really understand, you know, the bonding process. And frankly, from the people we've talked to in the insurance industry, they don't even understand it. So that's a confusing part of this thing. But anyway, these businesses employ thousands of people in Minnesota, and we don't want any adverse legislation that's going to put a lot of people out of work. So that's definitely a consideration here. Some of the definitions that were originally in the bill and some that may still be in there are a little confusing, we think. As I said, it covers a lot of different businesses as it's written, not only coin dealers, but also precious metal dealers, antique dealers, auctioneers, and other people like that. The definition, it talks about coin dealers and bullion, but there's more than just coins that are traded. There's also bars and other forms of precious metal products. So that should be considered as well. Precious metal content, there's a call for 1% of metal content in the bill. We can live with that, obviously, but more realistically, it might be 10%. And basically, most precious metal products, there's not much out there that contains less than 40% of precious metal in them if they're legitimate products. The melt value of a coin is kind of a confusing number also. Primarily, if you specify precious metal content, that's a better way to define what you're selling a customer, is what is that precious metal content, not the melt value, because the melt value is back and forth all the time depending on the spot prices of metals. The registration time is a little problematic, so we're suggesting 120 days for any new company, or once the bill is passed, any new company or existing company to register, that they would have 120 days to do the background checks that are required. And also, we think that employees should be registered within 90 days of hiring. That's not in the bill right now, I don't believe, but if any new hires come on board, that they don't wait for that year process to renew, that they be automatically within 90 days be registered. And also on the criminal penalty side, it says that it's a misdemeanor, and I know a misdemeanor, I'm told, has a $1,000 fine and 90 days in jail. It might be beneficial to raise that fine to some degree. And as a side note to this legislation, there's currently sales tax on precious metals. Now, the representative from the Attorney General's office mentioned that some of this fraud comes from out of state, and about 50% of it comes from out of state. Part of that is because there's sales tax on precious metals in Minnesota, and that's a big problem as we see it now. If you're paying 7% on top of a precious metal investment, these are mostly bought as investments, if you're paying that 7% fee in sales tax, that forces the customer to look out of state, because they can buy it in many cases from other companies out of state, and they're subjected to fraud. Once they buy from out of state, it's a lot more difficult for them to get justice and get their money back when they're dealing with an out-of-state entity. So we would recommend also that some consideration be given to, there's 32 states now that don't have sales tax on precious metals. We would like to see that introduced at some point as a bill. That's not the issue here. So anyway, our aim basically is to support this bill. We're in favor of it. We think it's a good thing for the coin industry because it weeds out all the bad apples. We don't want those people in business any more than you do, because they hurt the businesses that are legitimate. Thank you very much for your time. I'll entertain any questions.
Thank you. Representative Loon had a question, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think my question maybe is more for Representative Hillstrom or for the representative from the Attorney General's office. But I was wondering, in the cases that you illustrated of fraud and that, it looked to me like a lot of them were what I would just consider telemarketing scams. I mean, obviously they were representing themselves at coin dealers, but I'm just guessing these people weren't calling up and getting senior citizens to provide bank account information, and they weren't coin dealers or, you know, realtors or anything else. They were just criminals, hucksters. Do you have any information on how many of them were actually coin dealers, or there was some real legitimate connection to coin dealership other than just saying they were?
Mr. Fricke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, all of them were actually coin dealers. In fact, a couple of them were bricks and mortar buildings they were operating out of. It's been our experience that it's fairly common in the coin industry, in speaking with consumers, they make purchases from numerous states from several different dealers. So a lot of the information does go over the phone. A lot of it takes place through FedEx. In fact, people are shipping hundreds of pounds of coins by, you know, by FedEx airplane. But these were all actual bricks and mortar, with the exception of the one case, the Stella Group, the person who had, but she had actually worked at a coin dealership. The rest of them had had building addresses, and they had people working at an actual coin dealership.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the other witness would like to comment on that. I'd be interested in his perspective, too.
Thank you. I would just like to say that, yes, these people are coin dealers in the sense that they've set up a brick-and-mortar operation, but for the most part, these people know nothing about coins. They're selling a product, and they're scripted for the most part, so they really don't know what they're selling. They're just selling a product. They're not, in that sense, they're not legitimate coin dealers or precious metal dealers.
Mr. Chair, if I might,
Representative Hillstrom.
Someone from the Commerce Department and someone from the Better Business Bureau would like to make a few comments, and then...
Of course they would. Okay, well, let's invite them down.
Mr. Chair, I had a question for the witness.
Well, that's just too darn... No. Let's actually, Mr. Atkins, if you can stay there. Representative Zellers has a quick question for you.
Yeah, I mean, I know he spells his name wrong, so I get that you're not really... Mr. Atkins, I had two questions you said from... Representative Anzels and I both wrote down thousands of jobs. How many jobs are we talking about in the industry?
Mr. Atkins.
If you look at this bill the way it's drafted, it's a wide net, and as I said, it's not only coin dealers and precious metal dealers, it's antique dealers, jewelers, pawn shops, auctioneers. There are a lot of people who deal in precious metals, and so my guess, you know, that it's definitely more than 1,000 people. Easily, a couple thousand maybe. And there's probably, in the state of Minnesota, legitimate coin dealers, there's probably 100 to 125 scattered throughout the state.
Follow up to this?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the other question was, Mr. Atkins, how many other states have dealers registered, and if they do have them, do you know what their fees are?
Mr. Atkins?
Thank you. I don't know what the fees are in other states or how many states actually have dealer. I would say it's a very limited number. Most states will use the Federal Trade Commission guidelines for telemarketing. And all these people that you're talking about here that have committed fraud are also covered by those FTC guidelines currently. But I think it's important to note that the reason this bill is being brought into the state is so that they have better control. Because if you make a complaint to the FTC, unless it's millions of dollars, they're not going to get involved in it. So there's very little recourse for people who are taken advantage of.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Yes, ma'am. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Dana Badgerow. I'm the president and CEO of the Better Business Bureau of Minnesota and North Dakota. We are the first Better Business Bureau in the United States. I'm here to talk about this industry because, number one, the precious metals and collectible coin industries are really benefiting from these really high skyrocketing commodities prices. It's ripe for fraud. There are, however, many, many good businesses in Minnesota who are operating lawfully and ethically. 30 of them, in fact, are accredited with the Better Business Bureau, including the company who was just here. Asset Marketing enjoys an A-plus rating with our Better Business Bureau and has been accredited since 1986. However, there are some that fall notably short. The question was asked about the number of complaints. We've received 150 complaints in the last year from consumers, again, about half from Minnesota and half outside the state. There are common themes. One, the collection of large sums of money up front from consumers, with coins or bullion not being delivered in a timely manner or not being delivered at all. Coins being sold or shipped for exchange, with, again, payment delayed or not received, and then different coins of lesser value being returned when the consumer doesn't complete the deal. Questions about the authenticity of the coins and grossly inflated claims as to the amount of profits one can make in this industry. We've seen two companies, one of which has been mentioned, Crescent Equities and the Stella Group. They seemingly drop off the radar overnight, went to insolvency in the first case and a cloud of suspicion in the other, but not before dozens of consumers were bilked of large sums of money, tens of thousands of dollars in some cases. The Stella Group, a company we've awarded an F rating, we, in fact, alerted the Attorney General's office to the complaints we were receiving when we got a spike. There have also been problems with other companies. Take, for instance, the case of a consumer who purchased or believed he was purchasing $190,000 worth of gold from Capital Trust Precious Metals. Over time, the company did return $100,000 of that money. delivered nothing. But, of course, after several months and continued promises to refund the rest, the company eventually disconnected their telephones. To the best of our knowledge, this consumer never received the remaining $90,000. One of the owners, however, of that company went to form another company called Loyalty LLC. We have merged that file into our records and also now enjoys an F rating with us. Then there's the consumer who sent the now defunct International Rarities Corporation over $18,500 in gold coins that he wanted to exchange for collectible silver dollars. The company responded to the complainant originally saying they couldn't deliver because they had an internal theft in their office. They later responded they were going to reorganize under Chapter 11 and they would get their, all creditors would be paid back. Well, of course, as we often know, Chapter 11 converted to straight bankruptcy and the consumer received nothing. The owner of that company is now under federal indictment and is being charged with $2.7 million worth of consumer fraud. We do find that these companies morph from one identity to the other. The principals move, usually taking their customer lists with them. Then finally, there's an elderly consumer who was convinced by a telemarketer to sell 1,000 ounces of silver to Crescent Equities. He said he was persuaded to invest the proceeds because they offered the best bid. The representative said, "Do you have any other money you would like to invest?" And the consumer said, "Yes, I have $10,000 I'm going to bequeath to my son." The salesman convinced him to invest that sum as well into coins that may or may not have ever existed. And within weeks, the company representative was back in touch to say the investment coins have lost a lot of value. And at the very least, they were hoping to send him those coins along with a refund. Unfortunately, that company also went out of business, and the consumer received nothing. This is an elderly 83-year-old gentleman. So it's unusual for me to be here because the Better Business Bureau was founded on and stands for the principle of self-regulation. But in this particular case, it shows the need for more oversight. There's nothing that we can do with no enforcement powers to help these consumers when the companies are totally unregulated. So we do support the bill.
Thank you. Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, Peter Brickwitty, Director of Government Affairs for the Department of Commerce. I'll be very brief. Appreciate Representative Hills from bringing this forward. We've been partnering with the Attorney General's office on this. Our office also has received numerous complaints, very similar to what Ms. Badgerow just described along similar lines. We're continuing to work on the operational nature of the program that we'd be setting up with the Department of Commerce, along with the author and the Attorney General's office, and look forward to making this bill a reality in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty. We've got a couple minutes left for this bill. We've got Representative Sanders and Swedzinski and Woodard. Representative Sanders?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question, I guess, would be mostly for you, a bit on the process. Both of the testifiers said that there's still a lot of work to do on the bill. And typically, in the Commerce Committee, we've been very good about letting that sort of work happen after we pass a bill out of committee. But with the new permanent House rules, I'm not sure if there are amendments that are affecting the jurisdiction of the Commerce Committee. Would this bill be coming back so that we could then discuss those amendments? Or, and I'm not making a motion, but should we lay the bill over to then address those issues as they're being negotiated? And like I said in the past, yes. I've even had bills that we've had very substantive negotiations. We've always had kind of an oath in the committee that we won't bring it up until that bill is ready for prime time, if you will. Just wondering, Mr. Chair, in your opinion, what does the process look like now when it sounds like we still have work to do on a bill?
No, and Representative Sanders, I could not have said it better myself. In fact, was planning to do so when we took the bill up for a vote. Is that I do know that there's a couple other committees that would like to have some input into it. We also have the possibility that it may be coming back for a fiscal reason before our committee. But we'll monitor it. I got this really big guy next to me here who keeps an eye on all these bills, and not just from a gavel standpoint, but from sheer physical size. We've got the ability to pull bills back. I want to see what happens in the future committees, and I expect that most of the issues are going to be resolved. But I'd suggest members keep an eye on it as well. And Representative Hillstrom, to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Much of what needs to be done is in the jurisdiction of other committees. So you'll be seeing some of those amendments done in those other committees. When the money is worked out, if it's a fiscal issue, it will have to be.
Yeah. And I was actually listening very careful to Mr. Atkins and had the same observation. But to the extent that those things get changed and have commerce impacts, that's why we pay attention. And I'm sure Representative Hillstrom would be the first one to tell us if those issues arise. With that, Representative Swedzinski or Woodard, real briefly.
I'll be really,
got a lot
really,
of
really
that
quick.
Have come a long way on the next bill, and
okay.
I just want to make sure we
Sorry.
Get from them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Swedzinski.
Just a question. As we were thinking, ARP coming up on this, I can remember a couple weeks back my dad having to send in envelope. He had a tooth pulled from the dentist, and that's essentially dealing in gold precious metals being sent into kind of a same scenario where you would have money being, you know, you send in the gold or whatever sent back. Would that potentially affect that whole setup between dental issues? I know it says gold, but it also says melt value and content and some of that, so.
Sorry. Representative Billstrom.
No, Mr. Chair, it's coins.
Coins only, okay. That's
Thank
all
you.
I want.
Representative Woodard.
Even quicker question, Mr. Chair. So, we were talking about the precious metal dealer statute and it exempts these dealers from that statute. Did you look at just how we could incorporate it within the precious metal dealer statute?
Representative Hillstrom? Mr. Frickley?
Mr.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was brought to me from the Attorney General's office based on the lawsuits that they've been filing and the issues that they have, and so I personally did not look at that.
And based on the verbal or nonverbal cue from Mr. Frickley, I think you hit it right on the head. With that, Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 157 be recommended to pass as amended, referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion carries.
Thank you,
congratulations, Representative Hillstrom. Next up is House File 181. The Chair moves House File 181 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Norton, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And it's my understanding, Representative Norton, you have the A13-0032 amendment. Is that an author's amendment?
It is an author's amendment.
All right. The chair will move that. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Norton, your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm pleased to bring House File 181 before you today, and I appreciate your hearing the bill. I'm going to talk for just a few minutes and give a little background. And then we have a few testifiers. I have a room full of people who would love to testify, but because I know time is of the essence, we will limit it to a couple. And then if people have questions following and I'm unable to answer them, one of the providers or parents could be called forward. So I'm bringing forward what I consider to be an extremely important bill, and it's one that's come before this committee before a number of years ago and happily passed out on a bipartisan manner. I hope to be able to do so today. I will admit that it's somewhat controversial from a mandate perspective, and I know mandates are a concern for all of us, myself included, but it's absolutely the right thing to do with regard to policy and the treatment of our young children and families with autism. The bill today is asking you to level the playing field and create parity with our current MA-covered clients, and the parity will be with those on private insurance. I do want to make it very clear, however, because this question has come to me, is will this affect the entire market? And I'm sure the people in this committee know, but just to be perfectly clear, we cannot in the state of Minnesota affect ERISA self-insured plans. Those are federally regulated plans. And it's about 38 to 40%, depending on, I think, different reports, but roughly that amount. Those plans are regulated federally, and I can't do that. So I will be discussing the state-regulated, my request is for state-regulated plans. My hope is that at the federal level, those changes will come very soon. I'm pleased to report that the federal government just decided to cover their own federal plan. This benefit is now part of the federal plan, and I think that's probably the first step toward them putting it as part of their ERISA-covered plans as well. Through this bill, I'm asking that you acknowledge the healthcare needs of our children with autism and to put into law language that will assure that our families have access to the medically recommended, empirically supported early intervention treatments that our children need and deserve. And I'm bringing this bill to you because of my previous work with families. And I'm just going to take 1 second to tell you a little bit about my history, and that is some of you on healthcare have heard this already, but I worked for a number of years as an interagency family connection. And it was the school district in Rochester, social services, and public health. So it was a tri-governmental partnership. And my job was to talk with young families who were concerned about the development of their children, or a physician would call and refer us to see their children. And in the last year I was there, I had the pleasure of meeting lots of wonderful families, but six of those families had children that were diagnosed with autism. And in the 2 years previous, I hadn't run into any of these families. And it really speaks to the trend that we're seeing in this country and in this in the world, as a matter of fact, but particularly in the United States, of an increased number of diagnoses. And what happened with those children was that the families would be insured, the doctor would recommend treatment, and the families then would go to get that treatment and be turned down by their insurance company because that particular treatment wasn't covered. That in and of itself was a tragedy, but my job then was to help them go to the state and get treatment covered through TEFRA. So I would enroll these families who were of any income level you can imagine, that had insurance, that insurance company turned them down, that then I would say, okay, there's a program the state of Minnesota has called TEFRA, and if not TEFRA, MCHA, so there are two different ways to get coverage for your child, and I would enroll people's children who already had insurance, and I would enroll them in the state's plan, and then medical assistance would cover their therapies for their child as prescribed by their doctor. That was very frustrating to me. And we have someone who will testify a little bit later, for the families, because they're already paying for insurance for their family through their private insurance company, and then through TEFRA, it's a copay situation. And so for families, I think Brad will testify that upwards of $800 or $900 a month for a plan for one child, in addition to everything else he was paying. So a terrible thing was happening, and I was watching it. It's hard enough to face a family and tell them, you know, confirm their fears about a horrible diagnosis, let alone face them then again with having to say, my insurance doesn't cover it, what am I to do? And the other issue with this, just so you know, one of the key components is early intervention. Early diagnosis, and I'll share with you a little bit later about what MA is doing in that regard. But when families then are turned down and have to fight their insurance companies for 6 months or a year or 18 months, they're missing the precious time, the precious window of their child's young life where your outcomes are best. And so, you know, that year is gone and can never be regained. So what I'm hoping today is that you will give due consideration to asking our insurance companies as part of, it would actually be, this is new, be part of the essential benefit set to cover autism and in particular ABA therapies. And I say in particular because currently that's one of the therapies that's most often being turned down. It is not the only therapy. It is not necessarily the best therapy, although some of the providers would argue that it is. And it does have very good results, but it is one of the therapies that has the best results, and unfortunately families aren't able to access it. So there's no cure for autism, and you have a handout, if you will, that has a PowerPoint. I'm not going to go through that whole PowerPoint, but it does have definitions for you, for some of you who may not be aware of this. It has the incidence, which is 1 in 88. It has definitions of different types of coverage in there for you to look at, so I'd encourage you, as you're listening to me, you know, if you want to take that out and look at it, it has some good information in it. So autism, again, it has unknown causes, or research comes out daily with multiple different causes, and some of you are familiar with those studies. And so I think I'm just going to skip to my request of you, is that as you listen to the parents' stories, think about what it's like for a parent to be prescribed a treatment and then being told the treatment that will give your child the very best outcome, we're not going to cover. And that's what these families are facing. Or to be told, even though you're a responsible person, you bought insurance because you happen to be able to afford it, not everyone can, you've paid for it, you've done the right thing, and now you have to go get a second policy through the state. Think about the fact that children on medical assistance are currently being able to get coverage, including ABA coverage. There are some billing issues, and we can talk about those later if you like. And then if you get off of MA and transfer back into the private insurance companies, you're not covered. Think about those things as you move ahead. And I will just say two more quick points. One is on February 4th, a report came out in Missouri. One of the things that you might hear is that this is too expensive. Your handout shows you that of the 33 states that have implemented this and the ones that have been studied, it's 31 cents per member per month as an average, some as low as 10 cents per member per month change in membership. It is minuscule for the amount of benefit these families get. The article that was on February 4th is about the state of Missouri, which passed this recently. It says it's especially encouraging is the extremely low impact on overall health care insurance claims. The overall claims numbers suggest minimal, if any, impacts on premiums consumers pay. That's February 4th of this year. And again, the packet has information about individual states. So with that, members, I'm just trying to do the right thing for families. I think this is the right year to do it. It's going to work in kind of a nice parallel with some efforts that the state is providing MA clients. They're adding $12 million to the Department of Human Services to supplement better intervention and earlier intervention of our state's clients on MA. And we just hope that those that don't have the luxury of having the pretty premier coverage of MA can get that same treatment and therapy through the insurance companies. So I have a couple testifiers. I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, how you want to handle those.
Representative Norton, I appreciate you actually gave us a list of 25 potential witnesses or people here to answer questions. I appreciate, for the benefit of the bill's potential passage and the members of the committee's time, my understanding is that you've got kind of two folks that and maybe a third, and then we'll hear from some others that have signed up. We've got four or five. You've got Brad Tran and Sherry Radu that you wanted to hear from, and then there were three others, Lynn Nelson, Mike Hickey, and Ida Abdul, that are on the list. So I'd like to get through the two that you've identified and then a couple others, and then we'll see what kind of time we've got left, and we'll go from there. So why don't
Absolutely.
Should we start with Brad? Is it Tran or Tran?
Brad Tran from the city of Rochester, who is will
imagine that
himself,
the city of Rochester. Shocking that you'd have a witness from the city of Rochester.
Well, he can tell you he's not here because he's from Rochester. He's here for another reason. But I'll let him do
it. I suspect he is. But nonetheless, welcome from Rochester. Mr. Trahan.
Chair Atkins, members of the committee, thank you so much for having me. First of all, I was honored to chair the 2012 Minnesota Autism Task Force. It's a three-year commitment under legislative mandate. We were under a mandate to make sure that we implement a strategic plan for the next couple coming years as it relates to autism. I'd be remiss to not thank the State Departments of Health, Human Services, Education, and DEED. Previously, to respect the committee's time and yours, Chair Atkins, previously sent to you all via email the report that we submitted to the governor and legislative leadership. I won't go through all of that time. It's a read at your own time. However, I can highlight that it came out of the committee, the task force, that we heavily support that the 2012 Minnesota Autism Task Force position is it is now time to pass this legislation to help all kids. For transparency reasons, to let you know, I'm also a father of a son with severe autism. He is age 12. He would not benefit from this plan. Rest assured, behind the scenes, I'm working hard on the self-insured side to take on those industries as well. With that said, switching hats now to me being a dad, that's more important to me than anything, is that we did have to pay up to $900 per month for our son to receive the medically prescribed therapy his Mayo Clinic psychologist said he needed. The fact is simply this, is under the parental fee, families just can't save. In August of 2007, we had decided to keep a roof over our head, food on the table, or stop Reese's therapy. We had to stop his therapy, so he had to stop getting his medically prescribed therapy. The siblings are a big impact that my then fifth grader said, Dad, you know what, Dad, Mom, I hear you guys talking. You can't save for college for me, but here's what I'm going to do. I saw a commercial on TV about the Army where I can go in the Army and serve and save up for my college education. Since the fifth grade, and he's now an eighth grader, we've been going to visit the Army recruiter, and he's committed as ever to serve his country and save money and then help us out as well. It's tough to take as a parent, but I'm also a proud parent. I appreciate that the committee's time. Chair Atkins, appreciate your time. If anybody wants hard copies of this, I can get them to you, and I'll certainly entertain any questions at this time.
Mr. Tran, please thank your eighth grader for us, too. Thank you, and I think what we'll do is we'll keep going through the testimony, and then we'll come back to questions that we may have. Thanks again.
Thank you, Chair.
And Ms. Radu, I'm giving it the French version of the pronunciation. Ma'am, probably messed it all up,
no,
I suppose.
It's perfect. Radu.
Hi. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you all. Thank you for your time. I'm really nervous, so I'm going to start too fast. Just tell me to slow down.
Again, my name is Sherry. You can't speak too fast for this committee.
Okay.
We like fast.
This committee is a lot happier than this committee.
Yes, we are. Spread that around.
I like this committee. My name is Sherry Radu. I live in Blaine, Minnesota. I have three children. I had three children in 15 months. Yes, I had twins, and now we know where babies come from. House File 181 is long overdue and much needed to end the discrimination against those individuals with autism. All three of my children have received and continue to receive intensive early intervention therapy because they are all three diagnosed with autism. I have my oldest son is Zachary, and then I have my twins, Ethan and Emma. Ethan has already recovered from his autism. He goes to a typical classroom with no supports. He has weekly play dates. He goes to amazing athletes with the city of Blaine. He swims once a week. He is a typical kid. My elder son, Zachary, when we started therapy, he wouldn't even pick up a pencil. He wouldn't color. When he was at school, he would walk the fence line and not engage with his siblings, with his friends at school. When he ate at lunch, he would turn his chair around like this and eat. Now he's in kindergarten, and although the therapists go to kindergarten with him, they are fading out starting in about a month and a half. We're going down to 27 hours a week and then another 18 hours a week, and we should be completely done over the summer with best outcomes. That means he will go to school without any help. No more speech therapy, no more OT, no intensive behavioral therapy. He goes to swimming unassisted. He goes to amazing athletes unassisted. He is no longer going to speech or OT, and he's an amazing little boy. It has changed our life immeasurably. My little girl, Emma, is very severe. She is nonverbal. However, despite her disability, she's learned to feed herself, use the toilet, stay by me when we're in public, stop hurting herself, and is learning to read and communicate on her iPad. Just because she can't talk does not mean she is not smart. All of this is because of the intensive therapy they have received, but that is not thanks to my Blue Cross Blue Shield policy, which states we do not pay for services for or related to intensive behavioral therapy programs for the treatment of autism spectrum disorders, including but not limited to intensive early intervention behavior therapy services, intensive behavior intervention, and LOVAS therapy. Now, if you look at the language in the bill, it's pretty stinking close to my general exclusions, which I brought a copy for your perusal. Do you want to pass that around?
That's our new page. It's represented on me.
Sorry.
It's all good.
I don't know.
We're a happy committee, Mr. Dew, you know?
Next time I'll
If you want,
beer.
I'll pass them.
Okay.
What the heck?
He's a freshman, Mr.
Yeah. And where are the cookies, son? God okay. Darn it.
Call to order, all of you.
Yeah. I gave up on that years ago. The first time I carried this gavel around, I knew it was somebody. Anyway, we're sorry to interrupt.
Despite the mountain of evidence supporting the efficacy of early intervention, despite being told it would be covered after a one-year exclusionary policy, despite paying over $600 a month with a $12,000 annual deductible, despite the state employee group insurance plan paying for it, despite TEFRA paying for it, despite federal employee insurances covering it, the private health insurers in the state of Minnesota will not cover it. And I'm mad. House File 181 is about ending the discrimination against those with autism by mandating coverage for private insurers in Minnesota. If my children had cancer, this would not be an issue. There are over 500 published reports of the efficacy of ABA, IEIBT, LOVAS therapy. There's many acronyms.
Acronym.
Thank you. In fact, it's approved by the American Academy of Pediatrics, the U.S. Surgeon General, the National Institutes of Health, the National Institutes of Mental Health, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, and the National Research Council.
Now, and if you see your packet that was passed out, it goes into further detail with all this. Lastly, I would appeal to your fiscal responsibility to the taxpayers of Minnesota. There is nothing more fiscally responsible than long-term planning. Cost-benefit analysis completed by many other states who have passed insurance coverage have found that paying for early intervention is hugely beneficial in the long run, noting that persons with autism will grow to become adults dependent on publicly funded services for their lifespan, and autism does not affect mortality. Specifically, New Hampshire found a cost-benefit ratio of 2.24 when comparing the average cost of children who receive treatments of $1.5 million to those that did not receive treatments to $3.4 million. Aside from the emotional and moral concerns, you as policymakers are absolutely justified in asking what are the measurable long-term costs and benefits associated with appropriate treatments, and what does looking better look like? The most fundamental issue is related to outcomes. Do children who receive appropriate treatment get better, and what does better look like? Chawson et al. Suggests that getting better is not only possible but likely, and the vast majority of children who receive appropriate interventions experience marked improvement. In particular, approximately 47% of children recover typical functioning. An additional 40% make significant improvements, like my daughter, although they do not reach typical functioning. And the remaining 13% make little progress. The bottom line is that a simple change in policy could drastically improve functioning and quality of life for thousands of children with autism, and it's time for the private insurers in the state of Minnesota to pay their fair share. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Radu. Next up, we have Mr. Hickey and Ms. Nelson from NFIB and Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, respectively. Are they available? Maybe we could... Feel free to
Mr. Bill.
Join us and
nasty.
Welcome back to the committee. Thank you, Representative Norton. If we can, Ms. Nelson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lynn Nelson. I am testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, the 7 nonprofit health plans in Minnesota. I want to state at the outset that all Minnesota health plans cover autism in the commercial market. However, they may not cover every possible treatment. House File 181 would require coverage for intensive forms of behavior therapy, including ABA and EIBI, in the fully insured market. This does not impact the self-insured market. Treatment should not be based on a single method of intensive treatment. Instead, what should be developed is a customized, individualized treatment plan designed to meet the needs of an individual child. When prescribed by a healthcare professional, the programs covered by health plans include various forms of therapy, including speech, physical, occupational treatments, and medications based on the needs of the child. Those are all covered by health plans at this point in time for children that have autism. The cost associated with intensive behavioral intervention is incredibly high. In 2011, the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, the Minnesota's high-risk pool, spent over $4 million on 70 patients at one facility that provides ABA. $4 million on 70 patients at one facility. Their costs were higher than that for all the patients in MCHA. This is an incredible amount of money to spend on a treatment that has not been scientifically proven to be more effective than other autism treatments that are already covered by health plans. The additional expense will fall on individuals and small businesses at a time when healthcare premiums are rising due to the changes in the market rules, both inside and outside the exchange. This bill exempts the state from this mandate for both the state employee health program and public programs. However, the state would still be responsible for some costs. Under the ACA and the proposed rules for the essential health benefit set, which has already been set, by the way, and has been chosen as the default plan, as the health partners plan, that's already been set, and we have no ability to change that at this point in time. The state is permitted to mandate state-required benefits that are above this essential health benefit set, but the state must make payments either to the individual enrollee, to the issuer, or to the issuer on behalf of the enrollee to defray the cost of these additional benefits for all qualified health plans. This is not limited to those who obtain a federal premium cost sharing subsidy. It is for all QHPs, even those that are outside the exchange. If the state mandates coverage of specific intensive treatments for ASD, it will be responsible for defraying the costs of this mandate. In our interpretation, the bill as written would have a fiscal impact to the state to defray those costs. In closing, health plans have a fiduciary responsibility to their purchasers, the employers, and the individuals who pay premiums for health care coverage and to enrollees who use these services. This bill is drafted, basically restricts the health plan's ability to fill that responsibility. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. And it's worth noting a fiscal note has been requested on the latter point that Ms. Nelson raised, to the extent that the that there's a committee with jurisdiction over that fiscal impact, which I suspect will not be this committee, but will be a future committee. We'll ensure that the bill goes to that committee. So thank you for raising that point. Mr. Hickey.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. We're the state's largest business group in terms of entities and probably the group most affected by everything that goes on in health insurance in this building. And I wanted to make a few brief comments on this bill. We certainly understand how dire this problem is, and we've heard from a lot of the families who've struggled with it, and we're very involved with this bill in 09. But I think you have to come to grips with the fact that this is probably the most expensive mandate you're ever going to see. And second, the state has a real fiscal responsibility based on what Ms. Nelson just said, and this very changing insurance world with the ACA. And I think you need to be very cognizant of that as you proceed. As you proceed with this, I was very involved with this in 09 and 10, and got curious about the cost. And you know, Blue Cross provide a lot of good data. Their average cost was $30,000 per year per child. They had a high of 100. MCHA had a very expensive experience with it, as it was just mentioned. I did compare it to what we thought possibly was the most expensive mandate and probably the most essential, maternity. And median costs back in 09 at a major clinic in the Twin Cities were $10,400 to $16,000, not including prenatal and postnatal. And average cost for Blue Cross, the company that had something very akin to Representative Norton's bill at the time and no longer does have it, as you've heard, it's not in our essential benefit set. Average cost was $30,000. So $10,400 to $16,000 for a median cost at a major clinic versus $30,000. I think you have to come to grips that this is probably the most expensive mandate we've ever seen. The other thing we're very concerned about here, aside from the cost and how it could be passed on to small businesses, although I think with the impact and the interaction with the ACA, maybe it won't be. It's going to be a huge cost to the state, as it appears, is the fact that we're not picking up the vast majority of the private market. The ERISA market will not be affected by this, just as they aren't affected by any of the other 67, 68 mandates we have. And very disappointingly, just as they're not affected by the essential benefit set in a very exact way, I think they have to offer something akin to it, but they're not directly affected by the essential benefit set. It was just a terrible failing of the ACA to not bring in coverage for larger employers and try to equalize the insurance market in this state. But this bill, assuming it goes forward, assuming all the obstacles can be overcome, is not going to affect the vast majority of Minnesotans. And so there's going to be families that are not going to have coverage for this. 75% of the private market now in Minnesota is ERISA. 25% is state regulated, which you guys can have impact on. And it's a dwindling market. Mr. Chairman, I know you're in that market and you're struggling, Don. And it's a dwindling market. Mr. Chairman, I know you're in that market and you're struggling every year with your premiums. And this is dwindling. And that alone should give you great pause to do a mandate on something this lopsided that's getting worse and deteriorating more every year. And so for all those reasons, I think you've got something you really need to pursue cautiously. It's definitely going to be an impact to the state based on all the insurance people I've talked to, and both in the exchange and outside the exchange, and I certainly hope somebody refers this bill to Health and Human Services Finance Committee, and they really need to take a hard look at the costs of the state. And I appreciate the time today.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. And we have one final witness, and she did, like you, Representative Norton, Ms. Idle Abdul. She did this. I think she's got several other people here to answer questions or concerns, just like some of your witnesses were able to be here. So we appreciate You come in and testify, and if we've got questions for the people that you brought with, we'll ask questions of them as well. Welcome to the committee. If you just identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, members, my fellow parents and advocates. Good afternoon. Thanks for the opportunity again today. My name is Aidil Abdul. I am from Somalia. I have a son with autism, and I want to make sure that although there is some people here from Somalia that I speak for the voiceless, I speak for those that are whose children are born here. They are as American as I always say, apple pie, and Obama, and but they don't speak the language. They don't know where Martin Luther King is. They don't know the American system of politics. So I want to speak for them. I want to be able. I grew up in Boston, so I want to be able to bring their voices here. I am also a member of the Minnesota Legislative Task Force. I've been twice. The first time I was nominated by Senator Pogamiller, and then second time previous speaker Zellers. That's what I like about America. You can be in power and then not, and then go back and without civil war, right?
It has a humbling effect.
It has a humbling effect. Yes.
Sure does.
And I'm also part of the Federal Advisory Committee, and I've been nominated by the Obama administration and selected by Secretary of Sebelius. And that's a group of people. Usually the Federal Advisory Committee is made up of directors of National Institute of Health, National Institute of Mental Health, Department of Defense, which funds autism research, Center for Medicaid and Medicare, NIEH. I mean, there's all of them, HRSA, and then there are 15 public people. So I'm the only one from Minnesota, the first one, and the first African American, and the only one from the Midwest state. So maybe next time there'll be more people like me. But as you know, CDC states that 1 in 88 kids in America have autism, 1 in 54 boys, and in Minnesota Somali children, it's closer to 1 in 25. There is a study now being done by the University of Minnesota that has been funded by NIH, CDC, and Autism Speaks to find out the true prevalence of why autism is so high in us. And we will find this out in probably in the summer of this year. And as per information that I sent to you previously, the Minnesota Department of Human Services does not, and I repeat, I really would like people to understand, does not pay for applied behavior analysis, which is federal regulation by CMS, and half is by the state. And the reason for that is that CMS, which regulated the EPSDT, or the early periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment policies written by Congress over 40 years ago, before autism or ABA were anyone's radar, is what dictates CMS. And so for people, when they do pay for skills training, but not ABA. And they're not even supposed to pay by ABA. In order for a state to pay for applied behavior analysis or autism therapy, they have to apply through the 1915 waivers, home and community-based waivers, either the 1915C or the 1915I, in which case the state has to come up with half the cost, and then the federal government matches it. And so what we are asking, the reason we are against this bill is because we're saying if we're going to mandate, dictate, and order private insurance companies to pay for autism therapy such as ABA and call it ABA, we ought to make sure that we are doing the same for low-income children that have medical assistance and call it ABA. Call it exactly what it is so that it is the same. And there are people here from DHS that you can ask that, because what this legislation is saying that it will be, we think it's separate and unequal, because it will say that the private child that's most likely wealthy will have mandated private insurance coverage, whereas the low-income kid, who's mostly minority, who has public insurance, will have. We don't know. They don't have cover ABA. So we think that's a discrimination. We think that's a double standard. And we would like some fairness and equality for low-income kids to get the same therapies. Now, autism has silenced our children in Somalis. We're mostly oral society. The only thing I think we're good at is the ability to talk, and it has given us nonverbal autism. And I want to make sure that those children also have access to the same therapies that the private insurances have. In terms of saying that ABA has evidence that is recommended by Center for Medicaid or CDC, actually, as someone who sits on the Federal Advisory Committee, what they do is they recommend intensive behavior therapy it has more research than any other, but no one recommends 40 hours or 50 hours because that could be very, very expensive. It can cost up to $100,000 per kid per year. And you can do the math, there are about 17,000 children in Minnesota that have autism. And so while the research is not there, we still, yes, we should make sure the private insurances should pay. But we want to make sure that we're using rigorous science, scientific data, and so that is that an objective doctor, not the provider, but it's somebody who has nothing to gain or lose, so there's no conflict of interest. I just noticed you have a lot of Somalis. and so we want to make sure that there's a lot of, there's an objective provider that provides the medicine or prescribes the therapy so that it's not the provider, because then there's a conflict of, it could be a conflict of interest. And I want to use this thing that I've always heard Secretary Rumsfeld say, that you want to go to war with the army that you have, not the one that you wish you had. So we don't have a lot of research for autism, but we have to be able to provide therapies with what we have got now. And based on that, the idea of just unlimited amount for unlimited everything, I think is not doable. And then leaving the vulnerable and financial children that are financially not able to pay for this. Ms. Abdul, I'm almost done.
Just interrupt for just a second. Yeah, and sorry, if you could, because we've only got the committee for a couple more minutes. Yeah, thank you.
Well, I do want to talk a little bit about disparity in Minnesota. As you know, Minnesota is one of the healthiest states in the country, top 10, yet it is one of the worst for minorities for health equities. And this would only create to that. And I want to end with something back in 2008 when I was listening to some of the people that were helping Obama. They said, Rosa Parks sat so Martin Luther King can walk. Martin Luther King walked so Obama can fly. Please do not allow our children to sit at the back of the bus and not get the equal services that they so deserve.
Thank you, Ms. Abdul.
Thank you.
And Representative Davids, you're the one on the list. Make it a really good question.
Okay,
we're going to give you kind of the question.
Okay, this is a series of
like
the questions.
Jeopardy. Okay, a series of
okay.
the questions. Okay.
First of all, Brad Tran, I want to thank you for all the work you've done on this issue. You've just been amazing on this, and I thank you. I also want to join you in working on ERISA plans to get it covered there. We'll talk about that. Okay. Now, ERISA plans in the private market, not covered. Now, I've got a couple questions for Mr. Pender, so hopefully we can understand this a little better. House File 181 does not apply to State MA, Minnesota Care, or SIGA plan. So not the State Health Plan, not Minnesota Care MA. But now, do any of those three currently cover everything that's proposed to be covered in House File 181?
Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, I believe that those programs do not cover ABA therapy.
So we would be covering 25% of this of the private market, so we're leaving 75% of them off the table, and the state's not stepping up and going to cover this. Is that Representative Norton?
And
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
No,
sorry.
Fine.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was your question the initial question was, you questioned who was not being covered?
My question is out of MA, Minnesota Care, and the SIGA plans, the state health plan.
Yes.
How do they cover what would be in House File 181 currently?
Representative
Until
Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Until recently, all three covered it. As Idle was just saying a few moments ago, they do not, you cannot bill for ABA, but they pay for ABA services through bills coded as individual skills treatment. We held two hearings on this a number of years ago. So, and in fact, I believe Idle's children were on MA and received ABA services. So, yes, they cover it, but it isn't billed as ABA. It is billed as individual skills therapy. I will say CGIP has just had a change, which is why I removed what used to be, as you heard Blue Cross Blue Shield, Lynn Nelson testified a moment ago, that we were exempting them. We're no longer exempting them because when Blue Cross Blue Shield just pulled their coverage this last year, CGIP people are families are not covered. So they will. We will be getting a fiscal note for CGIP and for covering the insurance industries.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are we going to get all go to jail for fraudulent billing now if we're billing something illegally?
Mr. Chair?
You're scaring me here.
We thought you were going to take the fall, just in case.
I do that for you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Norton, you got a good response to that, right?
Yeah, we've actually had hours and hours of testimony on this, bringing people forward, and there's providers here that can tell you the same thing, and heads are nodding. They have MA, and they're being covered. It is an issue. I have actually requested the department write a letter for a waiver so that we don't have this continued issue. So I hope we're not all going to jail, but
Mr. Chairman, I've got some real concerns about this because, first of all, the private market 75% we can't touch until Brad and I put our heads together and get that done. Number one, which will never happen, we can get our heads together, but I've been trying for 30 years to, or not, Pender, how long? 21 years? 21 years, or Mr. Pender, I'm sorry. Mr. Pender to me.
But now we got both of you working on it.
Yes, I'd say about 21 years. Thank
you. And, you know, I've got Norwegian in me, so I keep beating my head against the wall because it feels good when I quit. Okay, so could CGIP come down here? I've got a quick question for CGIP here. And then, so we're not covering 75% of the private market, and it really bothers me in this bill. If everybody's going to play, everybody's got to play. We can't make ERISA play. Sorry, Brad. We can go have lunch, but we're not going to get CGIP. We're not going to get them in here. But to consider that CGIP, Minnesota Care, and MA wouldn't be included in this is very problematic to me. So if Mr. CGIP could come down and
Mr. Chair, CGIP is being included in this. I removed the exemption. So, yes, they will be now part of this.
Well, what are your feelings about that, sir?
Mr. Seagate, could you spell your last name for us?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is, that's S-E-G-I-P. My name is Nathan Morocco. I'm the director of the Employee Insurance Division, and I oversee the Seagate program.
Can you clarify this for us?
Representative, you know, essentially we're neutral in terms of the coverage. Typically what we like to do and want to do is to follow what the health plan's offerings are for their typical books of business. So we have health partners, we have Preferred One, we have Blue Cross Blue Shield, and so our coverage right now is consistent across all the health plans. And so that consistency would be more important to us than the specifics related to whether they should or should not be covered.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, and the gentleman that's testifying here, what do we have any idea what the fiscal note is on this for CGIP?
Mr. Morocco or Representative Norton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have requested a fiscal note, and they are working on it, but I don't think it's complete. And we will have it for HHS Finance, I assure you.
Okay, and Representative Norton, to that point, because I'm sure Representative Davids is about to make it, we've got the motion was to send it to the General Register. Are you, that was the motion. You're fully expecting, though, to go to HHS
absolutely.
Finance where the fiscal note will be reported. Very good.
And it will be in our omnibus bill.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as I'm looking at this, I mean, I know it's a work in progress, but to think that 75% of the private market, this does not include or involve, and then to think that we're billing illegally to get this covered is making me very, very uncomfortable.
We're not.
Apparently MA is.
MA is paying the bills, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You, Representative
but coding it illegally.
Representative
Mr.
Norton,
Chair.
I think we understand where Representative Davids is coming from, and I think.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'm done. I just don't want to go to jail.
And you're not.
I just don't want to go to jail for illegal billing. It just would hurt my feelings tremendously.
We have now made a record that Representative Davids does not want to go to jail for illegal billing.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to visit him there.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Tran would. has come up to the testifying table. Would you allow 2 seconds?
Mr. Tran, in light of all of the work that you've done over many years, I'd love to hear the final word from you if Representative Norton, who's the chief author, would be nice enough to give you that, and then we'll renew our motion.
Thank you, Chair of the Committee. Briefly, thank you, Representative Davids. I look forward to working with you on the self-insurers. I think us two bulldogs can get it done. With that said, it is important to understand that I really want to clarify something for the committee here, is that while this is a private insurance mandate, this is not singling out the people on the private spectrum, meaning we have many self-insured plans that already are covering this. IBM, and I will forward this to the committee tonight when I get home. IBM, 426,000 employees. University of Minnesota, 25,976 employees. Microsoft, 54,923 employees. So we do have self-insured plans covering. This is just making the playing field a little bit more. Now, we do have one medical center to the south of us, where I live, that we need to get on board, and we'll work on that, Representative Davids. But the fact is simply this. Their psychologists are still prescribing this medication, this therapy. Their psychologists are prescribing it. Their insurances are denying it. And I think you know me well enough, and Representative Norton, I'm going after him big time. We got to take care of that. So let the record reflect. Self-insured plans are covering it.
Mr. Chairman and Brad, will you come visit me?
Yes, please. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. And Representative Norton, I think that was a good move, given the last word to Mr. Tran there. We will, in light of the discussion, the chair will renew his motion, but change the motion to recommend the bill pass as amended and be referred to the HHS Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Member.
I'm going to jail.
Representative Norton, thank you to everybody who came out today. With that, we get back together next Tuesday. Everybody have a good week.